elderly, women and children. Any hope they had to get free would require killing, lots of killing. And even then, they might not get away. That sweet old couple Hadrian had seen on the way to the rally stood four rows back, still arm in arm, looking upon them with fear. Beside them, a beautiful blonde girl, Amir, stared at him wide-eyed in shock. The rest of the crowd was confused and frightened. These people weren't soldiers. They were a host of Griswolds, people who came home from a long day with nothing more than a miserable excuse for a chicken. And even so, their meager offering garnered a kiss from a grateful wife. None of this would matter to Royce.
"There's too many," Hadrian said. "What are you talking about, Vilar?"
Mercator asked.
"Who are these men?"
"They have been searching for the Duchess, asking questions and hanging out with the captain of the Duke's Guard. Just last night I came upon them spying on Griswold and Erasmus. I chased the little one, and the large one murdered Erasmus Nim."
"Nim's dead?"
someone asked, but was ignored. Hadrian tried to pull free, but it was hopeless with so many pressing in from all sides. Someone put an arm around his neck, tilting Hadrian backward and off balance. He felt them take his swords. Hadrian and Royce had been turned to face the front of the room. Mercator, whose arms were two-toned as if she were wearing black gloves to her elbows, stepped forward.
"Is what Vilar says true?"
Hadrian was encouraged by the sincerity of the question. She, at least, hadn't made up her mind. He looked to Royce, who refused to answer. Hadrian offered as charming a smile as the chokehold allowed, and focused on her.
"Yes and no."
Mercator wasn't amused.
"No, I didn't kill anyone. Yes, we have been looking for the Duchess. No, we aren't spies of the Duke. We've never even met the man. Yes, I know the captain of the guard. We served together years ago."
"I was there," Griswold said. "I saw you chase Nim last night. And now my friend is dead."
"Well, yes, I did chase him, but we got separated. And when I found him again, he was dead. But I swear I didn't have anything to do with it."
"He's lying, of course," Vilar said. "I'd lie too, if I were in his place. He's only trying to save his own skin."
"And why are you looking for the Duchess?" Mercator asked.
"My friend and I were hired by her father, Gabriel Winter, who was worried about the disappearance of his only daughter. He feared for her life."
"See? He admits it," Vilar said. "They know we kidnapped her. They know what happens tomorrow. Let them live, and we die. We need to kill them, throw their bodies in the Roche. Let it take their stink to the sea."
"No!"
a voice in the crowd yelled. The girl with blonde hair and blue eyes.
"Leave him alone."
She pushed through the crowd to face Hadrian.
"I know this man. I won't let anyone hurt him."
Royce looked at Hadrian, and Hadrian looked back, his face mirroring the confusion.
"Seaton?"
Mercator asked, pushing forward toward the girl.
"What are you talking about?" "This is Theraza."
The blonde pointed at Hadrian and stared at Mercator with big eyes. Mercator continued to appear puzzled.
"The Raza?"
Her eyes widened. She studied Hadrian closely.
"Are you sure? How can you be? How could he be?" "I'm positive," Seaton said. "I could never forget his face, his three swords, those eyes."
Hadrian, on the other hand, had clearly forgotten hers. She was vaguely familiar, but only because he thought she looked a bit like Arbor, the shoemaker's daughter from Hintendar, whom he'd been in love with at the age of 15. But this girl was a Mir, and Arba must still be living in Hintendar, married and with children by now. Hadrian had no idea why this young woman was defending him, or why she called him a Raza. Given his position, he wasn't about to deny anything she said. Vilar pivoted.
What's all this about?
This is Hadrian Blackwater, Seton said. 7 years ago, he saved my life.
Chapter 18. The Raza. She didn't say any more. The beautiful blonde Mir, who literally and figuratively stood between Hadrian and Royce and death, looked uncomfortable as she faced Mercator with pleading eyes. Vilar shifted impatiently. He likely wanted them dead, their bodies jammed down a sewer shaft. And while Hadrian obviously prepared to avoid that future, he was also curious to understand why this girl was so adamant about saving his life.
Seton, Mercator said gently, you have to tell the story.
The blue-stained mirror looked out across the crowd.
I know this isn't the... I'm sorry, but you're going to have to explain.
Seton nodded, but still struggled to find her voice, and when it came, her words started faint and so low that Hadrian strained to hear.
I was living in the village of Aylesworth, a few miles north. That's where I was born. Lord Aylesworth had defied King Reinhold. I don't even know about what or why, but one day the king's soldiers arrived.
Louder!
Someone in the back shouted.
We can't hear you,
someone else said. Seton's embarrassment showed, but when she resumed her story, her voice was louder, and as she spoke, it grew even more so.
Everyone was called into the castle. We were told that anyone left outside the walls would be slaughtered. I didn't think they would let me in, but I guess with my hair covering my ears, they didn't notice I was a Mir, and I slipped in with everyone else.
She paused and swallowed hard.
The battle went on all day, and on past sunset. I hid behind the woodpile. Then, in the middle of the night, the gate burst open. They set fires everywhere, and men in chainmail carrying swords ran through the courtyard, killing everyone. They didn't...
She stopped, her eyes searching the dark for the words.
They didn't look human. They looked like monsters, cruel and horrible. One was worse than all the rest. He was tall, powerful, and covered in blood. Among my people, there are legends of vicious creatures called Razas, terrible fiends, part elven, part beast, wholly possessed of evil. That's what he looked like to me.
She paused, regained her composure, and then continued.
He charged in, swinging this incredibly long sword. Lord Aylesworth's men attacked him from all sides, strong men, good men. I was certain they would kill this savage invader. Instead, they all died, their blood adding to his gore. He cut them down, cleaving off arms and legs, beheading, and in one case he cut a poor man nearly in half, slicing him from the shoulder to the hip.
As she spoke, her eyes focused on Hadrian, squinting as if she peered into a painful light.
He killed the horses, too, the ones the Lord's knights rode when they came at him. This man, this Raza, took down mounted knights with no more difficulty than a butcher slaughters a lamb. Before long, they were stacked around him, bodies in a pond of blood.
The crowd was quiet as she spoke.
Only the faint crackle of the campfire broke the stillness, the sound and the flickering light adding to the imagery she conjured. When all the soldiers were dead, The invaders came for the women. I was discovered. They liked my hair and how young I appeared. In the dark, they thought I was human.
She paused, her face tense, her sight dropping to her own feet. She took another breath.
I could smell the beer on their breath. The battle was over. The celebration begun. Everyone was drinking. I held on to the hope that I might survive, that if they continued to think I was human, they would let me live. I feared they would...
But they didn't want me for themselves.
Instead, I was dragged to the Raza. The blood-soaked man was in the middle of the courtyard beside a barrel of beer, his giant sword still in one hand, a cup in the other. He was drunk. The soldiers threw me and three other girls down at his feet. To Hadrian Blackwater, the hero of the battle, go the spoils, they yelled. Pick your favorite, Blackwater. He picked me.
Seton paused there and began to cry.
I was terrified. After seeing what he'd done to the Knights of Lord Aylesworth, I was certain this man was capable of unspeakable horrors. I knelt in the dirt, made muddy by the blood of so many. And I waited. All around me was fire, smoke, and screaming. My stomach was so bound in knots that I vomited. I didn't care if he killed me. I just wanted it to be over. I couldn't.
It took her a moment to find her voice again. And when it returned, she looked directly at Hadrian, as if she were speaking only to him, like they were alone.
Then he did something so unexpected, so unfathomable, that I thought I hadn't heard him correctly. He said, I'm sorry. The Raza's voice wasn't what I expected. It was soft. Soft and gentle. And sad. I thought he was speaking to me. I thought he was telling me that he regretted what he was about to do. But he never moved. He just kept saying it, repeating those two words. I realized he wasn't talking to me at all. He was looking at the pile of bodies. Staring at it, he drank and repeated his apology. Finally, he did look my way. He acted as if he'd just noticed I was there. I was sobbing, and he stared. I thought my life was about to end. When he reached out and grabbed me, I screamed.
And then?
Another from the crowd asked. A woman who glared at Hadrian with hate.
What did he do?
He...
Seton lifted a hand in Hadrian's direction, reaching out.
He held me. He held me tight, but gently. I was still terrified, expecting the worst at any minute. He, too, was crying. Then he let go. A couple of other soldiers came up. They saw he wasn't doing anything with me, and they tried to pull me away. Said they didn't want the blonde bitch to go to waste. He told them no. They weren't happy with that. But he said if anyone touched me, anyone, that he would kill them and their horse.
And their horse? Hadrian asked. I really said that?
Seton nodded.
You did?
Hadrian started to remember now. It was 7 years ago, not long after he had joined Reinhold's army. Most of the memories from that night had been mercifully washed away with beer. But some returned to him in nightmares, or came in flashes triggered by fire and screams. The last time was when Queen Anne of Medford died, when Castle Essendon went up in flames.
The next day,
Seton went on, continuing to look at Hadrian,
I was alone, Just me and the ruined castle walls. The army of the king had gone, and so had the Raza, who had protected me. I searched. I looked everywhere. Not a single person was left except me. I later heard folks who said the king was teaching his nobles a lesson. I only learned one thing, that I, too, would have died, if it weren't for this man. This man who scared me so much that I vomited out of fear. He protected me. I'm the only survivor of the infamous sacking of Aylesworth Castle, and I walked out with my life, dignity, and virtue all intact. And all because of him. Now, for whatever reason, fate has seen fit to swap our places, and so help me, Ferrol, I'll fight anyone who tries to harm him. She peered into Hadrian's eyes and added, And their horse. Seton took Hadrian's hand, kissed the back of it, and rubbed it along her cheek. Thank you, she told him, and lifting his fingers to her lips, gently kissed each one. Thank you. Thank you. Hadrian couldn't imagine that a young Mere, even given her gift for storytelling, could dissuade a mob bent on killing two outsiders threatening their existence. And yet, the demeanor of the crowd had markedly changed. Whoever this girl was, she held significant status in this underground society of theirs, one that exceeded her apparent age.
They still must die, Vialar demanded. Seton, you'll have to step aside.
The blonde, who had appeared so shy and gentle until then, sharply spun to face him.
You want him dead? Fine. But don't ask others to do it for you.
Seton pushed one of those holding Hadrian aside.
Let go!
She pulled on the fingers of another man. The others released their grips, and she pushed them back.
There! Go ahead, Vilar. You kill him, but by your own hand. Show us the way to your bloody revolution. Be the first to draw blood. Go ahead. Don't let my foolish little story worry you. The man is unarmed, surrounded. Go on.
Vilar stared at her, not Hadrian. In his eyes smoldered a seething hatred.
Do it!
The girl's voice rose to a shout.
We don't have to kill them, Mercator said. We only need to keep them from informing the Duke or his guards of our intentions. If we vote for revolution, our actions will make what they learned here moot. If we take no action, then there is no crime, and no one will believe a crazy story of murderous plots from two foreigners.
They know about the Duchess, Vilar reminded them. The Duke will kill us for that.
Mercator nodded.
Yes. Us. You and me. No one else. Her abduction was our doing, and our responsibility.
Even so, they have no proof, and it'll be our word against that of outsiders.
But if we kill them, then we—
He's right here, Vilar!
Seton exploded again.
No one is stopping you, go ahead!
She took a step toward him, staring him down.
You tell us that we must fight. You say we have to stand up for ourselves, but what you really mean is we have to die. To die for you, for your pride, your hate. You want us to sacrifice yourself so you can have a better future. That's not leading, Vilar, that's exploitation. You want any of us to listen to you? To follow you? To risk our lives for your vengeance? Then give us more than words. Risk your own life first. Take his life yourself, or shut up.
Vilar was shaking. Sweat glistened on his face in the torchlight. Hadrian thought he would attack her, hit the girl, make her stop. Instead, without a word, Vilar turned away, pushed through those watching, and disappeared into the crowd.
Griswold,
Can you get some rope? Maketa asked. We can...
In the drama, nearly everyone had forgotten about Royce, who hadn't said or done anything. Those holding him had relaxed their grip, likely believing they were in charge of the quiet one. They discovered their mistake when one cried out in pain and another doubled over as the thief twisted free of all the rest. In a flash, Alverstone appeared, followed by gasps and a sudden retreat of those closest to him. Sorry, don't like ropes.
Royce?
Adrian spoke in a measured voice, the same one he would use when calming a spooked horse.
Don't? Don't do anything that you... I mean, that I'll regret.
Would be more productive if you told them that.
Royce spun, blade out, and everyone took another step back.
We aren't going to hurt you, Maketa said.
She was one of the few moving toward him, but not quickly. Smart woman, Hadrian thought.
Not going to tie me up, either.
We can't just let you walk out.
If you were to tell the Duke...
Who said anything about walking out?
Royce fanned the dagger as he moved closer to Hadrian.
We came for the Duchess, Jenny Winter. You're going to give her to us.
Maketa stopped and folded her arms, staring at him.
Or what? You'll kill us all with your dagger?
Royce frowned, glanced at Hadrian, and sighed.
Why does everyone jump to that conclusion with me?
Polka dots, Royce, Hadrian thought. Polka dots.
Look, Royce told her, I don't care for being locked up or killed. Big surprise there, right? And I'm guessing you'd prefer that we don't reduce your gathering's population by even a single life, true? Given her story, he indicated Seaton, I suspect you understand it'll cost you at least that if you force the issue. So, let's try something else. How about a trade?
We have the Duchess. I get that, Maketa said. But what do you have that we could want?
Royce smiled.
The Duke.
No one returned Hadrian's swords, but neither did they attempt to tie the two up. Maketa left the crowd in the main meeting hall with a promise to update everyone before morning. Then she sent a runner to fetch someone named Seely, convinced Griswold to come along, tried in vain to discourage Seaton from doing the same, and chose a dozen of the larger Calaeans and Mir to act as guards. Then the entire entourage escorted Royce and Hadrian across the street. They entered a small, dilapidated building with a partial roof, broken windows, and a mostly intact wooden floor. A well-worn path had been cleared through the debris down the stairs to the cellar. Four stone walls without a single window, six wooden chairs surrounding a rickety table, and the stub of a candle melted onto an overturned cup made up what Hadrian suspected to be the headquarters of the revolution. Maketa took a seat and gestured for Royce and Hadrian to join her. Seaton looked at the dozen men and Mir who were trying to look as tough as possible.
You don't need them. Not all of us share your unwavering faith,
Maketa told her.
It's not faith. I'm just saying...
Seaton smiled shyly at the guards.
No offense, but if Hadrian wanted to kill us... They wouldn't be able to stop him.
He doesn't have his swords, Griswold said.
I know.
Maketa puzzled on this a moment. As she did, an older, dark-skinned woman entered in a rush.
Maketa, I was told you needed me.
We do.
Maketa motioned to the open chair.
This is Seely Nim, Erasmus's widow. She will be acting in her husband's stead as a representative to the Calaeans. Agreed?
She looked to Griswold, who nodded.
I'm sorry to impose on you at a time like this, Seely, but we have an emergency.
The widow shook her head.
Don't go to worrying about me. This is bigger than an old widow's problems.
Erasmus would never forgive me if I didn't pick up his part in this.
Mercator folded her hands on the table and took a breath.
Okay, we're listening.
Royce straightened up and faced the three. Hadrian was telling the truth. We were hired to find and, if possible, rescue Genevieve Winter, the Duchess of Rochelle. If she's still alive, we can help each other.
She is, but it doesn't matter. Her husband doesn't care what happens to her.
Or he does, but not enough to meet our demands.
Or there's a third explanation.
Which is?
That he doesn't know anything about your requests, and he thinks his wife is dead.
Mercator's brows knitted, her eye shifting in thought.
That's not possible. Is it?
She looked to Griswold, who only shrugged.
How were your demands relayed? Royce asked.
We wrote them down and left a note in the carriage the night she was taken.
Royce shook his head.
Maybe it got lost in the debris, or it blew away. But in any case, the Duke knows nothing about the note.
What makes you say that?
We've been investigating her disappearance, remember? And Villar was right about us meeting with Captain Wyberg of the City Guard, but he didn't say anything about finding a note. And Leopold had the guard searching the city, and none of them knew about any demands. In fact, Wyberg thinks she was most likely killed by some rival for the crown.
Royce leaned in. If you could prove to the Duke his wife is alive, and make your case for reforms, he might agree in exchange for her return. Your original plan can still work, which means there would be no reason for the revolt tomorrow.
Isn't that what you wanted?
Mercator's eyes showed a momentary glimmer of hope, but then it vanished.
Except there's absolutely no way to get to the Duke.
I can't enter a shop to buy a loaf of bread at midday. So there's no way anyone is going to let me into the estate at night, especially to have an audience with the Duke.
Royce looked at Hadrian.
I'm guessing the captain could get us an audience, right?
He nodded.
Wyberg could manage it, and he owes me favors much larger than this.
So, all we need is proof that his wife still lives. If we have that, I think he would listen to what you have to say.
Then, if I could persuade him to agree...
Royce can be very persuasive, Hadrian explained. The thief nodded.
I have a lot of money riding on this job, so trust me, I'm motivated.
You want me to speak face to face with the Duke?
Mercator gave a little laugh.
That sounds incredibly risky. What's to stop you from handing me over and saying, this is the kidnapper?
Royce shook his head. If we did that, you'd have the Duchess executed, right?
The Duke would lose his wife, and I'd be out of fortune.
Where's the benefit in that?
Technically, Royce could make even more money if he let them kill her, then gathered up the heads of those responsible and carried them back to Gabriel Winter. But Hadrian imagined such a debate was for another day and a different crowd.
Hadrian watched Mercator. She was no fool, nor was she one of the typical meek elves he so often saw on the streets of Medford. While appearing not quite middle-aged, she had a demeanor that suggested otherwise.
Her eyes surveyed them with a careful judgment born of wishful thinking but tempered by years of disappointment.
Mercator looked to the widow Nim and Griswold, both of whom shook their heads.
These boys have no skin in the game that they're setting up,
Seedy said.
We're betting the house, and they're tossing in a copper din.
Mercator nodded.
She's right. Your fortune doesn't stack up against the gamble we shoulder in this proposal. I need greater assurance. Lives are at stake, mine being the least of my worries. But the two of you, the architects of this grand plan,
of no serious risk.
Royce faltered, searching the ground for ideas. Hadrian noticed Seaton was still watching him. She wanted a solution almost as much as he did. His time in the East had always been a dirty stain on his life, but she'd showed him there had been at least one pinprick of light. Another one would be nice.
"I'll stay," Hadrian declared.
"What?" Royce and Mercata asked together.
"I'll spend the night here, under guard, as insurance. Royce can escort you to the Duke. If he betrays you, has you killed or whatever, then your people can kill both me and Jenny Winter."
Griswold pointed at Seaton.
"According to her, that's not too easy. But unlike Royce, I'll let you tie me."
Mercator looked surprised at the offer, and nodded.
"I could agree to that."
"Yes," Griswold nodded. "That seems fair."
"No, it doesn't," Royce said.
"In fact, that sounds really stupid."
"Why?" Hadrian asked.
"Do you plan on betraying anyone?"
"No, but..."
"But what?" "I don't like working under pressure, okay? And what guarantee do we have that they won't..."
"Won't what?" Hadrian asked.
"Won't kill you anyway."
Hadrian looked at Seaton.
"I have a protector."
The blonde smiled.
"Yes, you do."
"I'd be happier if it were someone a little taller," Royce said.
"Does everyone agree?" Hadrian asked. Griswold nodded.
"Seely?"
Mercator turned to the Calaean.
"What do you say?"
"Old Eras never did like the idea of fighting. Couldn't even bring himself to argue with me. Just said, 'Seely, there's no reason to be that way.' And he was usually right, too."
Her lips shifted as tears slipped down her cheeks.
"People got the wrong impression because he was always haggling, but he just liked the sport of it. Couldn't understand why folks refused to get along. He would have wanted to find a peaceful solution."
She looked around to nodding heads.
"We agree to this."
Mercator gave a single nod.
"So it's decided. Let's pray to each of our gods that this will work. We're going to need all the good fortune we can get."
Chapter 19. Living Proof. The key was done. Jenny finished it more out of habit and a sense of accomplishment than anything else. She had no idea if it would work, and only a mild desire to test it. Curiosity was the only driving force now. Escaping felt almost counterproductive. Better to be killed and retain a thread of hope than live and discover the truth. In a choice between the murder of her body and a murder of her spirit, she suspected the former might be best. At least she wouldn't be forced to suffer needlessly. Besides, if it worked, the key would only open the collar. The shackle around her throat was held fast by a warded padlock, but the door's lock was a tumbler, and she didn't know anything about those. She rubbed the key with her thumb.
"You did a good job, old girl,"
she said aloud, and she wasn't just referring to the key. She was alone again. Mercator and Vilar were both off to the meeting, which meant that Jenny didn't have long to live. If they decided the way Vilar wanted, Mercator would return to perform her final task. Jenny wondered if she would follow through with it. While she'd never killed anyone, Jenny imagined it wouldn't be an easy thing to do. But it was clear that no point in Mercator's life had been easy. The Mir hadn't said a word, but that last argument with Vilar, how he looked at her, and what he didn't say, told Jenny everything she needed to know. Mercator would kill her. She wouldn't like it, wouldn't want to, would probably apologize and possibly cry as she dragged a knife across her throat.
But she'd do it.
Maketa was a survivor, and her sort did what they had to.
Jenny looked at the key. She thumbed it, feeling where the rest of the teeth had been, noting how smooth it was. Her old trunk key was now a skeleton key. The problem with warded padlocks, like the one that held the collar, was that they only had a few configurations for the obstructions, or wards, that made it impossible to turn any but the correct key inserted in the hole. With so little space in each mechanism, and so many unique locks to make, some were bound to be identical, which meant keys for one could open others that used the same design. Worse, almost all warded locks left the first notch unobstructed so that a universal key, a skeleton key, could be used. This was handy for when a key was lost, or when someone had hundreds of locks to deal with and didn't feel like carrying hundreds of keys. Jenny had learned this after discovering a consistent discrepancy in her inventory. Her warehouse in Kulnora had a fine-looking warded lock, big and new, but a locksmith explained how useless the thing was to anyone who knew the first thing about how locks worked. This was bad news in a city that was home base to the Black Diamond Thieves Guild. She replaced the lock with a far more expensive and elaborate version, and the thefts stopped. Jenny thought nothing more of the matter until she woke up with a collar locked on her neck and an old chest key in her purse. How many noble duchesses know how to pick a lock? How many have potential skeleton keys in their wrist purses? So, what are the odds Maketa and Vilar used an irregular ward lock? Jenny felt her odds were good, but getting the collar off was only half the battle. The other was the door. Maketa opened it for every meal. The mare wasn't very big, but Jenny had never been in a brawl. She didn't know how well she would fare, and she honestly didn't want to find out. That's where the sharpened coins came in. If she could... But why bother? I gave all my love to a man, and received only lies. What do I have to look forward to now? Jenny decided to stop looking away and face the unpleasant truth that some people, no matter how hard they try, never get what they desire the most. She tossed the key, letting it skip across the stone into the corner. Jenny heard someone. Quick steps rushed up and flew into the room on the other side of the locked door. She held her breath. This was it. Whoever had come was there to end her life. The door would open, and she would see a knife, or a sword, or a... Can you write? Maketa asked. Jenny was confused. Do you hear me? Can you write? Are you talking to me? Jenny asked. Maketa was moving around outside the door, shuffling loudly. She appeared to be in a hurry. Of course I am. Don't take that tone with me. How am I supposed to know? I'm locked in a room. Maketa paused, took a breath, and began again. My apologies, but I'm in a bit of a rush. And you should be too, if you want to get out of here. Get out of here? Is this a trick? Doesn't make sense. Why trick me? Yes, I can write. Wonderful. I need you to do something for me, and for yourself. Jenny slid to the door and peered out the central knothole. Outside, Maketa flipped over piles of wool. She was searching for something in a mad dash. I need you to write a letter to your husband. Are you serious? Yes. Maketa found a feather and cut the end of the quill with a small knife. Why, I'd love to, dear. Can I tell him where I am and give him your best wishes? Do you know where you are? Maketa set the knife back down, then reconsidered and stuffed it in her belt. No. Maketa found a sheet of parchment and grabbed it up. Then, I suppose not. What do you want me to say? Tell him what we talked about,
Ask him to do what is right, and mention something that only you two share, so he'll know the message came from you.
Wait.
What? Leo doesn't know I'm alive?
There's a rumor to that effect.
A rumor? You don't know? Why don't you know? By Ma, are you serious?
Maketa opened the door and set the parchment and quill before Jenny.
We think the Duke never received our first note, and that's why he hasn't done anything.
But if you can convince him...
If that's true, does that mean... Could Leo love me after all?
Jenny's heart leapt as she took the paper and quill. Then she hesitated.
No, she thought. It doesn't explain everything else. Him keeping his distance, our separate beds, his failure to defend me.
Leo doesn't love me,
she told Maketa,
an admission that brought tears.
He married me so he could be king. This won't change anything.
You don't know that.
Jenny bowed her head and sniffled.
Yes, I do. I pretended he cared, but it's not true.
She set the quill down and wiped her face with the back of her hand. Maketa sat down opposite her.
Maybe you're right. Maybe he doesn't love you, and only married you to better his chance for the crown. Makes sense. But he still needs you, if he's to become king. And if he's crowned, then you'll be a queen.
I don't care about that. Never have.
You should.
Why? Why should I care? If he doesn't love me?
If this has all been a charade?
If all he wanted was a crown?
It could save your life.
I'm not sure I want it saved. If the only person who ever said they loved me doesn't,
I'm not sure life is worth living.
Mercator's tone lowered, her eyes growing stern, nearly angry.
It's not just your life at stake.
She changed from hectic jailer to disapproving teacher scolding a petulant student.
If the Duke doesn't agree to reforms, there will be an uprising followed by a retaliation. Hundreds will die. Maybe thousands.
Maketa picked up the quill.
I don't care if the Duke doesn't love you. And right now, you shouldn't either.
You have the power to save lives.
Your ladyship, isn't that worth pretending he loves you for at least one more day?
Jenny looked down at the parchment and sniffled.
As pathetic as it sounds... You're the closest thing I have to a friend in this city. Call me Jenny.
She sniffled again, and reached out and took the quill.
I need ink.
I don't have ink,
Maketa said. Then smiled, and looked at her arms and hands.
But, Jenny, I think I can manage something.
Chapter 20 Jiggery Pokery. Royce waited in the shadows between two stone giants, torturing himself. Standing in the dark, narrow street, dividing the imposing Imperial Gallery from the immense Grom Gallimus, he watched people carrying lanterns and moving through the sprawling riverfront plaza, celebrating a festival of rebirth. The populace danced and sang in joyous abandon, as they said goodbye to winter, the way a squirrel waved farewell to a frustrated dog thwarted by high branches. They wore bright colors and waved streamers of green, blue, and yellow. Giddy as children, they were oblivious to the dangers around them. They were prey. He'd grown up in a city like this, old, dark, and decrepit. Royce was a panther in the grass, gazing out at a watering hole after a drought. But he wasn't there to hunt. He was waiting for Maketa. As unpleasant as it was to ignore the temptation to act when the revelers were such ripe pickings, they weren't the source of Royce's agony. What needled him was the way the stakes of their job had risen while the payout hadn't. What Royce suffered was the contradiction that was Hadrian Blackwater. While he hoped that his friend survived the night, he also felt, in a purely theoretical way, that Hadrian deserved to die. The fool had willingly surrendered to a mob of revolutionaries, a group that believed he had killed one of their own. That was stupidity taken to an art form, like giving up higher ground or leaving an enemy alive. And yet, this was only a symptom of a larger, more perplexing issue that irritated Royce like an infected splinter. He couldn't ignore that their lives had been saved by a random act of kindness that Hadrian had once shown to a total stranger. From Royce's perspective, the best insurance for a long life was murder. Potential threats, even remote or indirect, had to be eliminated. Not broken, not reduced, but burned out of existence. Royce left no hatred to smolder, never granted revenge the potential to return to roost. He wouldn't have violated the blonde mirror either. The very idea was repugnant. But given the circumstances, he imagined he would have seen her dead. When you're part of a force that wipes out an entire town, you don't leave anyone alive. Not even a young girl. Back in his Black Diamond days, when Royce was a member of the infamous Thieves Guild, he had been one of three assassins the BD employed. The other two were his best friend, Merrick and Jade, Merrick's lover. Jade had been a young girl too, and just as sweet as Seton, but she'd become one of the most feared assassins in the known world. Not despite her gender, but because she was female. Men always underestimated her. Was Jade a mere too? Thinking back, he couldn't help wondering. Not all mere have elven features. Since meeting Hadrian, he'd recognized that the man was unnaturally lucky. But that thought, that excuse, was too consistent an occurrence. It had become less a rationalization and more of a truism, which irked Royce. If it had been me, if I had saved her life, Seton would have spent the last 7 years training to kill, and one by one she would have seen to it that each of the Duke's soldiers who took part in that raid died a horrible death. Then when I showed up, she'd be overjoyed to find the one guy that got away. My reward would have been a vivisection. But it had been Hadrian, and he received a tear-filled oratory of appreciation and an advocate for his defense. That was the problem with life. It often failed to be consistent. Nothing could be relied on. Royce was positive that if he dropped a rock enough times, he'd eventually see it fall upward. He was also certain that this event would coincide with the worst possible moment for it to occur. What others saw as miracles, Royce perceived as dumb luck. Still, there was a problem with that. And its name was Hadrian Blackwater. By all accounts, the man shouldn't have survived childhood. Maybe he had caring parents who watched over their son. Yet another example of the universe showing preferential treatment. Still, after he left home, he should have died within a week. A month, at best. Ridiculous skill with a sword can protect someone from only so much. Tonight is a good example. We both should have died, but we didn't. Why? This was the puzzle that frustrated Royce, the embodiment of the sliver. It challenged his very clear and proven world view. Aside from Hadrian's professional soldiering, during which he apparently killed the equivalent of a small country's worth of men. He was unusually kind, empathetic, and forgiving. Everything in Royce's life had convinced him that those three idiosyncrasies were synonymous with swallowing brews of arsenic, cyanide, and hemlock all in a single gulp. Even if the result wasn't suicide, Such attributes should result in massive handicaps when trying to survive in a world that claimed to value such qualities, but in reality punished people who possessed them. Except in Hadrian's case, it hadn't, and by virtue of being with him, Royce had been rewarded. The worst part was that Royce couldn't pass it off as a rock falling up. This wasn't the freak singular occurrence. 4 years earlier, the idiot had made the worst mistake of his life by staying to save Royce when they were on top of the Crown Tower. Hadrian had the opportunity to escape, but he had stayed, performing a suicidal defense on behalf of a man he hated. Anyone else would have paid for such an error with their life. Not Hadrian Blackwater. And again, by virtue of being with him, Royce had lived, too. Then there was Scarlet Dodge. She was another person Royce would have killed if Hadrian hadn't been with him. Another example of a good deed rewarded. Royce and Scarlet had once laughed at Hadrian's naivete, his moronic integrity. But given how things turned out in Dulgarth, Royce didn't find it funny anymore. Once could be explained as a fluke. Twice was a coincidence. But three times was a pattern, wasn't it? And if it is, what does that pattern reveal? Royce pushed the thought away. It didn't expose anything. Weird stuff happens all the time. Doesn't prove or disprove anything. Even a rock will eventually fall upward. Right? He was making too much out of nothing. Something he criticized others for doing. People spot a goose heading south in early fall, and they expect an early winter. They see a squirrel amassing nuts and convince themselves the winter's snows will be deep. All this from an over-eager goose and a greedy rodent. One thing doesn't dictate the other. Hadrian was lucky, that was all. Except, I don't believe in luck. Luck, as it was understood by most people, was some supernatural force that benefited one person more than another. An incomprehensible, impetuous power that blessed certain people without reason, and would abandon them just as inexplicably. What a load of nonsense. Luck was a word insecure or envious people used to explain events they didn't understand. What they didn't realize was that everything had a certain probability. Those people described as lucky were merely individuals who increased their odds of success either by their actions or lack thereof. A man who lives on a mountaintop but isn't hit by lightning isn't lucky. He simply didn't go outside in a storm. People made their own luck. This too had been an axiom that Royce had believed. Now these two established principles were slammed against each other, and he didn't care for the new landscape the collision left behind. The pattern was wholly strange, an alien thing that challenged all he knew to be true, everything he'd learned. If Royce didn't know better, he would almost conclude that... Mercator appeared, moving through the crowded plaza. She had added a blue shawl to her attire and dropped part of it over her head. Does she own anything that isn't blue? She entered from Vintage Avenue, but that didn't mean anything. Royce had known Mercator for only an hour, and already he knew she wasn't stupid enough to travel in a straight line from where Jenny Winter was being held. The best he could determine was that the Duchess of Rochelle was somewhere in the city or on the outskirts. Somewhere Mercator could have gotten to and back in less time than it took Grom Gallimus to chime twice. It took her several minutes to cross the plaza. Because this was the night before the big feast, it seemed everyone was out. Royce watched as Mercator threaded her way through the crowd, looking for anyone who might be following. She seemed unobserved, and Royce met her in front of the cathedral. That didn't take long. Are you certain you have ample evidence? You realize we won't get a second chance at this. If he isn't persuaded that she's alive, this whole thing fails. Mercator presented Royce with an understanding smile. the sort an adult would offer a child who has just said something stupid. "This will do the trick." Mercator drew out a folded parchment. "A letter." Royce was disappointed.
"Were you expecting a finger?"
Behind Mercator, not far from the fountain, a Calaean man was juggling flaming torches that made muffled whoomp sounds every time they spun. "To be honest, yes. Fresh-cut finger shows the victim was recently alive, and there is the added bonus of indicating the seriousness of the kidnapper." Mercator continued her patient smile.
"You've done this sort of thing before, haven't you?"
"Hadrian and I weren't hired for our looks."
"Nor for your intelligence."
The insult was presented without malice, making it sound more like constructive criticism. Royce was never one for criticism, constructive or otherwise, and certainly not when it came to his area of expertise. The presumption of this Mia was astounding if she thought she could educate him on blackmail and coercion. She looked to be the type to spend most of her days scrounging garbage for food or begging for handouts in the street. A ring of people in colourful clothes held hands and danced in a circle as a trio of fiddlers played in the centre. All the dancers were red-faced, from either the exertion or drink. Likely both. Royce found it hard to believe that he and they were the same species.
"The Duchess wants us to succeed," Maketa said.
"Given that her life weighs in the balance, and since she knows her husband better than either of us, it's sensible to assume she is far more capable of providing us with the means of convincing him to act. Wouldn't you say?" Royce didn't answer. As simple as that concept was, he re-ran it twice through his head, looking for an error. He couldn't find one, beyond the possibility that the Duchess might encode a message only Leo would understand, which would convey her whereabouts. This, however, seemed unlikely.
"What?"
Maketa asked. "Nothing." Roy shook his head.
"You're shocked. I can see it on your face. You didn't believe it possible Amir could think."
Royce shrugged and gave a glance at the revelers laughing and dancing, as if they were mad from fever. "Don't take it as a slight. I'm usually shocked that anyone can think.
But how much harder to accept from me, Amir and a female? You assumed I was incompetent, didn't you?"
She was right, and such an admission wouldn't have troubled him a year ago. But a year ago, he'd thought he was human. Discovering he was also a mere made it difficult to think that those with mixed blood were inferior. Difficult, but not impossible. The fact that he didn't exhibit elven features allowed Royce to believe his blood was only slightly tainted. This was a weak, impractical argument. But prejudices were a form of fear, and fear was often senseless. Groundless anxieties permitted ludicrous rationalizations. At least they did in the quiet, controlled spaces of his own mind. Such carefully crafted constructions tended to fall apart when facing the reality of a blue-stained mirror who showed no evidence of inferiority. "Yes," he admitted. No offense or anger surfaced on her face. Instead, she nodded while maintaining that understanding smile.
"So, what now?"
"We're waiting on Roland Wyberg. The captain of the city guard is supposed to meet us here. He wasn't at the guardhouse, but I told one of his men that I'd found the Duchess, and he anxiously volunteered to fetch him immediately."
"I hope he didn't lie or exaggerate." "You didn't mention me, did you?"
"No. But would it have been a problem if I did?"
Mercator sighed. "It could. People have a lot of preconceptions about my kind. We're not what you think, you know. We didn't cause the destruction of the Empire. We aren't lazy or stupid, nor are we abominations. We don't carry disease, aren't cannibals, don't steal babies or worship Uberlin.
We're the same as everyone else, except more destitute because the rest of society hates us. They keep us dirty and desperate, then condemn us as if we chose our circumstances. The irony is that